bedroom that became mine. All of the handwritten messages were facts about death. Within 3 days of dying, the enzymes that digested your dinner begin to eat you. What a remarkable person who lived here before us, I'd thought with glee. We could have been best friends. A friend I would have remembered. Because you remember friends, don't you? Even ones from long ago. And you remember boyfriends, no matter how inconsequential. How could I have forgotten an entire boyfriend? I remembered random boys I pulled into the dissection room to make out with in high school. I remembered a sickly boy named Darius who felt me up on a school bus trip to the La Brea tar pits. And yet a whole boyfriend has been wiped from my hard drive. Was this possible? Oh, him, I said to Kiki at the cat show, quickly, urgently, to cover up my distress. Sorry, he just looks so different these days. I dramatically slapped the side of my head. Brain fart. Inside, though, I was panicking. I'd already forgotten the name Kiki had told me. All I remembered was that it was long, complicated, and pretentious. My tumor was definitely back. That had to be it. The doctors hadn't dug the whole thing out. After the procedure, I was told I might forget moments, names, faces, details. But this seemed bigger than anything like that. This was an entire person. Kiki had looked at me with concern. I actually never met him, you know. I only recognized him from your Facebook page. I frowned. I don't have a Facebook page. Sure you do. I looked at it after we went to the bar that first time after workshop. There were pictures of you and Leonidas on it. You were both wearing UCLA sweatshirts. You looked really happy. I didn't know whether to continue to rebuke this claim or go along with what she was saying in an attempt to appear in control of my reality. I decided on the latter. Oh, yeah. Well, I've been trying to put him out of my mind. She cleared her throat. He wasn't abusive, was he? Her guess was as good as mine. But because I didn't want her to worry, I smiled confidently. No, nothing like that. It's just alarming when you hear someone talking about you across a room. She frowned. What was he saying? Forget it, I said. There was no way I could mention that stuff about Palm Springs and the cops. Then I touched the hem of her sweatshirt. That's quite the fashion statement. Kiki stroked the cat's puffy face. Yeah, I ran into this breeder my parents used to be friends with, and we got to talking. She sells these on Etsy for $80. I couldn't say no. And then she'd blathered on about the McDonald's latest Abyssinian and how the winning Maine Coon looked like an asshole and had let out some putrid gas. I thought the Leonidas thing had blown over, but she gave me nervous glances when we got in the car and headed for home. When I went to my bedroom, I heard her whispering downstairs to Stedman. I can only imagine what she said. Eliza forgot her ex. Is that normal? As soon as I bolted the door to my bedroom, I pulled up Facebook and typed in my name. I have a fan page for the Dots. It has 834 likes. There are no pictures on the page besides the cover art and my headshot. Certainly none of this Leonidas person and me in UCLA sweatshirts. But if Kiki really did look me up on Facebook shortly after we met, I wouldn't have had the Dots page yet. I hadn't even finished the novel. I keep searching, but I can't find a separate personal page for Eliza Fontaine, the girl. So am I crazy, or is Kiki? Maybe someone took my personal page down? But how could someone remove an account I don't even remember? Then I pounced on my directory from my dorm at UCLA from last year. There was no one named Leonidas in it. Not that that really proved anything. He could have lived somewhere else. Was he like the boyfriend I'd written in the Dots? Had I met him in art history class? But I remembered art history. I remembered the teacher with her shelf of dark hair and how she always wore saris even though she wasn't Indian. I remembered Mariel, the girl I sat next to in each class. She told me once that if Pablo Picasso was still alive, she'd definitely give him a blowjob. I don't remember a boy in the back of the room holding court. or a boy giving astute answers about Mondrian, or a boy I slowly became obsessed with, almost against my will. So how had we met then? Why had we broken up? Why was he talking about me and Palm Springs and the police? Who was he talking to? And then, as I was lying there in my bed, a memory struck me. A hard soccer ball kicked to the side of my head. I saw myself lying on the tiled floor in a back hallway. I smelled mozzarella and grease, and I heard loud 90s glam rock on a tinny radio. I saw that same redhead from the hotel lobby standing over me. Leonidas. I assumed it was him, though this memory played for me like a television show I'd never seen, and I had to scramble to figure out the characters. Glared at me. The blood drained from his cheeks.
"You promised," he said through clenched teeth. "I can't believe you."
"I'm sorry," I heard myself saying. In the memory, I was covered in blood. Was it my blood? Was my brain just conjuring up blood for dramatic effect? I looked back at him, and he lurched toward me, and I let out a squeal. "I'm so sorry!" And then poof. No more. If there's anything true about the memory, why was he so angry with me? What sort of crime had I committed? Had I had an affair? I wouldn't put that past me. In high school, I cheated on every boyfriend I had. It was like I couldn't help myself. Maybe this is why I blocked Leonidas out. I'm ashamed of what I did to him. Maybe I am scared of him and what he might do in revenge. Could he have been in Palm Springs, wanting to hurt me? It kills me that I don't have an available answer. I think my brain knows, but it isn't able to tell me. Possibly because of a new tumorous invasion choking vital pathways. Why have I taken all those vitamins then? Why have I eaten so many fucking blueberries? I should have been gorging on pizza and cigarettes all this time. I could have avoided the shaman in the desert and all that exercise I struggled through. Maybe this is why I drank those bottles of Stoli at the Tranquility. Maybe it's why I've been groping for liquor whenever I can find it these days. I still feel buzzed, in fact, from a shot of whiskey I drank before leaving my house to come to my parents. I'm digging my own grave instead of letting my faulty brain dig it for me. There's comfort in what I can control. I pull out my phone and type in the address for Dr. Forney, the neurologist I recall being somehow related to my tumor diagnosis. The office picks up when I call and ask to speak to the doctor. "Is this an emergency?" the nurse asks. "I'm not sure," I whisper. But then I get myself together and say I just want to schedule an MRI, just to check. Off the record. It's not like anyone has to know. "You'll need to get a referral for that," she says. "I can make you an appointment with Dr. Forney here in the office. He has an opening next week." On second thought, maybe I don't want to talk to the doctor. Dr. Forney might be able to tell I've been drinking, and he'll scold me. Dr. Forney might know about my fall into the pool and assume I did it on purpose. He might recommend I recover in a place like the Oaks. But what I want is empirical evidence only. A picture on a scan. An amorphous, ruinous blob. "Thanks, I'll call back," I tell the nurse, and hang up. I start up the walk to the house. This is the street tourists use to enter Griffith Park, to hike to the Hollywood sign. And today, like always, the street is jammed with parallel parked rental vehicles. Giddy tourists armed with cameras and water bottles leisurely saunter in the middle of the road as though heading to a large outdoor concert. All of them have winsome, eager smiles of people who don't have to stay in LA for any length of time. When I was a teenager, I used to hang out an upstairs window and throw water balloons at them. "Stop!" Gabby would hiss when she caught me. "That's not nice." I always rolled my eyes. She was always so obsessed with being nice. On the porch, I stop. I suddenly smell a perfume I recognize but cannot place. It actually stuns me for a moment, rendering me stupid. I hear screeching in my head. The door whips open.
"Eliza!"
Bill's arms are outstretched in a T.
"How are you? Doesn't it smell
good out here.
I smiled dazedly. Yes. What is it? He gestures to a tree I've never noticed before. The thing has big orange fruits hanging low and breast-like from branches. When did you plant that? I ask. He shrugs.
It was here when we moved in.
He looks at me curiously.
You all right?
Part of me wants to collapse at his feet and tell him the opposite, but I'm afraid of what this will usher in. Better that I handle this myself, quietly, without panicking anyone else. Fine, I say in a clipped voice. Just great. Bill lets me through the door. Once Bill and Gabby moved in with us, the spooky old house was gutted and transformed into an airy, open rectangle with spare furniture and high-end electronics. The moldy furniture that had been here when we arrived was moved out. The secret graves were bulldozed over. The stained glass windows of hollow-eyed saints and sinners were carefully removed and replaced. I got to keep the creepy death words in my closet for a while. But one day, apropos of nothing, my mother said she'd painted over them. They were just too morbid, she said. I cried for days. I mourned the loss of those words. I rewrote the facts I could remember in pencil, but it wasn't the same. I didn't have the same shaky script. I couldn't get the backward slant of the letters just right. How do I remember that so well? But not Leonidas.
Well, I gotta say, you look great.
I jump and turn around. Bill's in the doorway, rubbing his hands together. Thanks, I say, though I know I don't look great. Not at all. I appreciate Bill's practiced cheerfulness, though. The day the father and son pulled me out of the ocean, Bill drove me to the hospital for treatment. He acted as though we were driving to somewhere innocuous, like Home Depot.
Oh, look, a farm stand,
I remember him saying halfway there, pulling over.
Eliza, you want a peach?
I often think my mother doesn't deserve him, though perhaps they work in a yin and yang way, his kindness balancing out her prickliness.
Want anything to drink?
Bill asks now.
We've got water, soda, orange juice.
Water is fine, I lie.
I'd kill for a shot of bourbon.
He makes a little knicker sound and disappears into the kitchen. I pad toward the built-in bookshelves, also a new addition after he moved in. They've got a lot of titles lined up, though most of them are about the Civil War, Bill's forte. Also on the shelf are Southern romances, the pastel-covered kinds, and a gritty memoir about a woman who grew up in a one-room shack and had psychos for parents. They must have been my mother's, though I've rarely seen her reading. But then there's this thin book, really just a pamphlet, lying on the sleek, lucite side table. On the Meditation of the Mind. On the back is a picture of a man with bulging eyes and frizzy Einstein hair. I stop short, a chill running through me. It looks like the guy who said hello to me in the cafe with Posey. His name is Herman Levinsky. Goosebumps rise on my skin. Why do I know that name? I grab my phone and find Google. Herman Levinsky is a healer in Los Angeles. He leads people on spiritual journeys through Death Valley. I'm about to call up his website when the floor behind me creaks.
There you go.
Bill appears with a Perrier. A lime bobs cheerfully on top. I show him the book. Who is this guy? Bill shrugs.
No idea. Must be one of your mom's.
He takes the book from me and puts it back on the shelf. He takes my arm.
Come on, honey. We need to talk to you.
I give the spine of the book one more glance. On second thought, maybe the writer isn't the guy from the cafe. That guy didn't look capable of writing anything. Still, there is something about this book that starts an itch in my brain. I get a flash. Brief, foggy, more a smell and a sound than an actual image, of being in an antiseptic room, someone's clogs slapping quietly on the floor, and a voice saying, "Okay, count backward from 10." It makes me shiver. What is it from? A nurse giving me anesthesia, maybe, when I had the tumor. Some crackpot I visited post-tumor to ensure I didn't get sick again. Okay, I say, turning to Bill. I want to talk to you guys, too. I want to tell them about Leonidas. If they see him around, they need to tell me. If he knocks on their door, they can't let him in. Maybe they can fill me in on who he is, too. Bill might have renovated most of the house with exotic woods and high-end blinds and robotic pneumatic systems that sucked up dust before it has time to settle. But my mother kept the kitchen almost as it was when we moved in. The cabinets were repainted in clean white, but the knobs remained the same round, bland brass buttons. The stove has four burners. The countertops are not marble, but made out of some spongy material with little flecks of what they want you to think is stone smashed into the surface. Our old kitchen table, the one I used to impale with the tines of my fork, is still in the corner, as are the wooden chairs with the wobbly legs. My mother and Gabby stand together at the kitchen table, though when I walk in, they jolt apart, as though I'm a big electromagnet reversing their polarization. Hi, I say to my mother, and to Gabby, I didn't know you were coming. They hem and haw. Then something on the table catches my attention. It's my book. Just sitting there, spine closed, cover glossy. My heart is in my throat. I point at it. Where did you get that? Gabby's eyes grow wide. My mother doesn't answer. I start to tremble. I'm serious. Why is it here? We got it in the mail today, my mother says in a low voice. There was no return address. My mind is racing. Damn it, Posey. I specifically told her I didn't want my family to receive it. I'd been so clear. She wouldn't have gone against my wishes. Only, does that mean someone else did? Not Laura, either. So who? The person who wants to hurt me? I swallow hard. Is that insane? My mother lets out a breath. And we have a problem. There is suddenly a surplus of saliva in my mouth. It takes three swallows to get it all down. What do you mean? My mother points to the book. Her eyes are blazing. You can't actually publish this, Eliza. Sweat dots my back. I think, for a moment, I've heard her wrong. But then Bill adds, we've tried calling your editor already, but she hasn't called back. Wait a minute, I say slowly. So, you read it? My mother looks exasperated. Yes, we read it. And you didn't like it, I guess. I laugh self-consciously, though it comes out choked. My mother's eyes bulge, as if this is the most asinine question I could have asked. I am burning with shame. Maybe what I've worried about all this time is true. My book is literally the stupidest, pettiest, most ridiculous piece of writing ever to be put down on paper. Only, if it is, why did my agent applaud it? Why did my editor buy it? What the fuck is going on here? I review what my mother just said and feel a ball of anger knot in my chest. And you called my editor? Yes, and you have to call her too, my mother says forcefully. I grab my book and press it to my chest. I didn't ask for you to read it. I never told you about it because I knew you wouldn't like it. Just like you don't like anything I do. Eliza, Bill starts. That's not, no, forget it. My cheeks are blazing. I have to go. I'll see you later. Wait. Bill catches my arm. It's just that the story you wrote. Are you sure? Maybe you should pull back, have a think. You're a lovely writer. You must have other stories in you. I wrench away. Everyone else thinks it's great. My agent tells me it's getting a lot of good buzz. My mother looks at Bill in horror. Others have read it? No one but my editor and my agent, and maybe some others at the publishing house, but reviewers are looking at it now. For a split second, I wonder if Laura has recruited my mother in a twisted reverse psychology initiative, because now I want it to go to reviewers. I want the whole world to review it. I want to show her that others think it's decent. Why does she get to deem something unpublishable? It's like she's taking it personally. Then I get it. I step back and laugh. You're pissed about the mother character, aren't you? Because I made her nice at first, but then she's totally unsympathetic. You think it's you. My mother bites hard on her bottom lip and says nothing. It's so telling. Of course, it's the only thing she noticed, and she isn't able to see past it. And she decided, based upon that fact and that fact alone, that my book is shit. Her disapproval of the one true thing I've done with my life so far falls in line with everything else she's ever felt about me. So I shouldn't be surprised. So why am I surprised? Why do I care so much? Why does it physically hurt? My mother strides forward, yanks the home phone from the wall, and hands it to me. Please, call your publisher right now. Tell them you've changed your mind. I bark out a laugh. Just because you think it's a bad book doesn't mean you get to cancel its existence. Eliza! Her eyes are wild. She looks like she might cry. Please! I take the receiver from her and slam it back into its cradle. No, I say. You're not being fair. Bill places his hand on the table. Eliza, why did you write this book? It feels like a trick question. I don't know. Because I've always wanted to write a book. There's a bubbling sound at the stove, and a charred scent to the air. My mother glares at Bill. He holds his palms up in the air. No one moves. My skin prickles. Does this have something to do with someone pushing me into the pool? My mother shuts her eyes. No one pushed you into the pool, Eliza. But the guy who pulled me out of the water saw someone running away from the scene. No, he didn't. I scoff. How do you know? Why would the guy lie? I think the person who pushed me was Leonidas. My mother, to Bill. Her college boyfriend? Then to me. He wouldn't do that. How do you know? Finally, Bill seems to notice the burning sauce. He sidles to the stove to save it.
I mean, isn't Leonidas 100 pounds soaking wet?
He's still capable of pushing, I say through clenched teeth. He could be dangerous. He hurt me when we were dating.
He did?
My mother looks astonished. I duck my head. I really have no clue. I don't think it was Leonidas, Gabby says in her small, meek way. I turn to her, eager for more. Why do you say that? One shoulder lifts. She trails off.
He always seemed nice.
Didn't he rescue rats from a pet store? My mother's voice cracks. Wasn't that his big claim to fame?
No, that was Dot's boyfriend you're thinking of. You're getting us confused.
I'm astonished she retained anything from the novel, considering how vehemently she loathed it. Look, I overheard him talking to someone on the phone today, about Palm Springs, and about calling the police.
But couldn't it be a coincidence? Gabby says carefully.
That's ridiculous, my mother says at the same time. My head swivels between them. It's not ridiculous. Someone is after me. Someone wants to hurt me.
Eliza, honey.
Bill presses his hand on my shoulder. It's warm and large, and his fingers clamp down on bone.
No one is going to hurt you. We're right here. We'll make sure. We want you to get better.
Across the table, Gabby nods. When I look at my mother, Her eyes have softened. The atmosphere distorts. They look so earnest suddenly. Like my well-being really is the only thing on their minds. And it seems possible in this moment that if I just give in, if I tell them that I'm lying and that what happened in Palm Springs was just like all the other times, their love for me will blossom, and they will keep me safe. I mean, it's partly what I'm worried about anyway, right? That I'm sick again? So why can't I let them help me? I picture a fantasy. I'm whisked upstairs and taken to my old bed. Bill wheels in the TV and brings me soup. Gabby reads to me from a magazine. My mother cries quietly into a handkerchief. But as I open my mouth, I realize that in order to attain this sort of care, I'll have to tell them something that isn't true. And I can't do that. There was someone at the pool that night, I say instead, feeling so weary. There really, really was. Bill's shoulders slump. Gabby's head drops on her neck. My mother presses her hands over her eyes and lets out a long breath. Then, shaking her head, she turns and walks out of the room. Just like that. "Please call your editor," she says over her shoulder. "I'm serious." I watch her back disappear through the door. Upstairs, a door shuts. The AC, another addition after Bill and Gabby's arrival, kicks on. I whip around to Bill and Gabby. "What the hell is going on?"
"We're worried about you," Bill says softly. "We're not sure what you remember."
A movement to my left distracts me. I shoot up. A dark, shadowy face is in the courtyard, looking in. I rush to the window. There's someone in the... The shadow shifts. I blink. And it's me out there. I blink, and everything mutates again. It's just my reflection. I rub my hands over my eyes. The yard is empty. Even my reflection in the glass is gone. I press my nose to the window, craning my neck far to the right. There are petals strewn across the brick patio. Leaves have fallen into the pool. The palms are still. The chrome hood over the bricked-in grill is immaculately shiny. I turn back to Bill and Gabby. They're both pinned against the island as if a blast has pushed them there. I've caught them in strange poses. Gabby's shoulders are turned in and her hands are limp claws by her chest. Bill's got one arm slung across her waist, and his feet seem planted. It's like our own little Pompeii has happened, freezing and hardening them in ash. "Did you see it too?" I whisper. Bill's throat bobs as he swallows.
"I didn't see anything."
He glances at Gabby, and a silent conversation flows between the two of them. Together, they peel away from the island and sit back down at the table. "Sorry, I just thought..." I clear my throat, still feeling the prickly sensation that someone's watching me. Then I turn to Bill. "What were you saying?" Bill shakes his head.
"Forget it."
He pushes a plate at me.
"Fill it up. You're getting so skinny, you're disappearing."
From the Dots. Dorothy was waiting in the school parking lot in a black-on-black Mustang convertible. She wore a large floppy hat that tied under her chin and big sunglasses over her eyes. Dot's heart swelled and nearly burst. This had to be a mirage. There was no way her aunt had come back to her after all this time. She'd given up hoping.
"Darling,"
Dorothy said, stepping away from the car and opening her arms. It was her voice, exactly as Dot remembered it. And when she pulled Dot to her chest, everything felt just the same as all those hugs from years ago.
"Oh, darling, I've missed you so much."
Dot was too stunned to speak. But when she did, the questions came out like a geyser.
Where have you been? What have you been doing? Were you in Paris? Were you writing? Did you have a ukulele and a poodle?
The only thing she didn't ask was the most important question. Why did you go? Why did you leave me?
Come, come, Dorothy said, opening the car door. I'll tell you everything. Best not to tell your mother about this, though.
Dot snorted. Don't worry about that. They drove around L.A. for a while. Dot didn't say much. She was too overwhelmed and intimidated and didn't want to say the wrong thing. They pulled into a familiar neighborhood to the west of town.
I thought we could go here for old time's sake, since we made up so many stories about the place, Dorothy said.
She pointed to a restaurant in the distance. M&F Chop House, read the neon sign. Across the street, St. Mother Maria's, that second hospital, loomed gray and institutional in the dull midday light. Dot didn't really want to be here. She hadn't returned to this part of town since she was sick. But there was no way she was disappointing her aunt, so she said nothing. Instead of going through the front double doors, Dorothy parked in the back and led them around a side entrance, down a set of stairs, and to a door where she knocked three times.
Like a speakeasy, she said cheerfully. This entrance is for the important people.
A man with a round, smiling face, pig-pink skin, and a Winnie-the-Pooh voice opened the door, welcomed Dorothy with a hug, and led them up a set of indoor stairs lined with framed restaurant reviews. In the dining room, the walls were paneled in warm-colored wood, and the air smelled like meat. The man introduced himself to Dot as Bernie. He sat them in a booth that was so far in the back of the room, Dot was pretty sure no one knew they were there. It struck Dot as odd. When she was young, Dorothy used to grouse whenever she wasn't given an establishment's best table. When she called this to Dorothy's attention, her aunt's eyes sparkled.
Honey, this is the best table. People are going to leave us alone. Now, look at this place. Remember all those stories?
Dot beamed shyly. Of course she remembered. She was thrilled Dorothy remembered. She hadn't been sure, over the 12-year gap, what she'd meant to Dorothy. Dorothy ordered champagne, then took off her sunglasses and removed the scarf from her head and neck. Dot gasped. In the 10 years that had passed, she'd pictured Dorothy aging and growing lumpier. But the woman who stared back at her had smooth, lineless skin. There wasn't a single gray hair in her black mane. Her eye makeup was dark lines and dramatic sparkles, and when she smiled, her teeth were whiter than Dot's. Dot could plop her down on her college campus, and half the guys would hit on her. Only her hands, with their protruding veins and smattering of freckles, and the slightest beginning of gnarl, gave her away. Dorothy looked carefully at Dot, too. So long, in fact, that Dot began to feel self-conscious. She ran her hand over her hair and straightened her sweater. She was wearing a black cashmere boat-neck sweater she'd found at a consignment store. It smelled slightly of mothballs and smoke. On her head was a small netted hat. The netting kept getting in her eyes.
"You've grown into a remarkable young lady," Dorothy decreed.
Dot was so overcome she thought she might cry.
"Thank you."
"It's quite uncanny how much we look alike, isn't it? We could be twins."
Dorothy pressed her hands to her bosom and sighed.
"If only I'd been here to see you transform."
"Why weren't you?" Dot asked before she could stop herself. Dorothy sighed.
"It wasn't possible."
The waiter delivered drinks. Dot was surprised she'd been given champagne, too. She stared at the bubbles rising to the top of the flute, feeling uncertain. Through the years, kids thought she was fucked up on seizure drugs and party drugs alike. But she'd taken the doctor's suggestions to heart. She drank a little from time to time, but only beer. Anything harder frightened her. She feared excess would shepherd the lesions back into her brain, like loser teenagers squeezing through a cracked-open back door at a VIP club.
"Are you sure this is okay?"
Dot pointed at her drink.
What, because of your illness?
Dorothy waved her hand.
It's perfectly fine. Besides, you're almost 21, aren't you?
She sighed with pleasure.
My little lady.
Dot put the drink to her lips. It tasted fruity and sour at the same time. The bubbles exploded on her tongue. She felt surprising heat as the liquid went down her throat, but it warmed her stomach pleasantly. She smiled at her aunt across the table, and Dorothy smiled back.
Two lovely ladies having a cocktail, Dorothy proclaimed, giving Dot a wink.
Dot beamed and took another sip. They were back together. It felt so right. Dorothy was staying once again in her same bungalow at the Magnolia.
They'd held the old suite for me, she trilled.
She'd come back a few days ago.
Back from where?
Dot asked.
Oh, so many places,
Dorothy sighed, finishing her drink quickly.
First, she really had been working on a section for her book, she said, one whose research took her to French and Austrian castles, then to Morocco, then other parts of Africa. In Somalia, she met a tribal leader named Otufu, and they'd begun an affair. Dorothy couldn't quite picture a life with him. The African way of life was so different from anything she was used to. But she thought it would be interesting research for a book, so she remained.
Only, then she found out that Otufu was involved with warlords in the area, running guns or some such.
A real baddie, she explained.
I had to get away from him. I had to get to the U.S. Embassy, but it was a risk to leave his compound. The place was rife with armed guards. A maid helped me sneak out in the middle of the night. I ran barefoot to the embassy. Some of Otufu's men were chasing me. They had to helicopter me to Italy for safety, but they suggested I remain in hiding for a while. Otufu knew people everywhere. He thought I was going to talk. There was a price on my head.
Holy shit, Dot gasped.
I stayed in Rome for a while, in this ramshackle apartment that barely had any heat. I wrote a little, but mostly I just ate, read books, and took lovers. She gave Dot a saucy look. It was a heady time, and time passed so quickly, before I realized it really. After a while, the embassy told me that it was probably safe for me to return to the States. I missed you so much. I wanted to see you. So, here I am.
Dot blinked at her. That's amazing.
Oh, well, you know.
Dorothy signaled the bartender for another cocktail. But then her eyes widened at something across the bar. Dot turned to follow her gaze. A woman in a black suit was sitting at a table near the window. Her hair was slightly less blonde than before, and there were crow's feet at the corners of her eyes. But Dot recognized her immediately.
Dr. Coder, she said,
half standing, and then her heart dropped to her stomach. Dr. Coder was in a wheelchair, the motorized kind, bulky and huge. Her twisted fingers fumbled to eat a salad. A strap around her waist held her body upright. Dot pressed her hand to her mouth.
What happened to her?
Stop that. Dorothy pulled her back down to sit. It's rude to stare.
Her nails dug into Dot's arm. Dot stared at them. They looked, for a moment, like talons. Her gaze fell to her plate. The steak juices were thick and red, marbling her potatoes.
That was my only reservation in coming here, Dorothy said quietly. I worried we'd run into someone from that time. I mean, I know it was hard for you too, dear. So hard. But you can't imagine what I went through, day in and day out, not knowing if you'd live.
Dot nodded. She glanced back at Dr. Coder, surreptitiously watching as the woman scooped up a bite of creamed spinach. A splotch fell to her shirt, and the man she was with, a kindly fellow in a tweed jacket, leaned across the table to dab it off. Dr. Coder gave him a bright, beautiful smile. After that,
Dot looked away, deciding she wouldn't give Dr. Coder another thought. Whatever Dorothy wanted, Dorothy would get. Dorothy smiled, seeming to register this.
So, she said smoothly, tipping her drink to her lips. Tell me about you. You're in college now. I can't believe it.
Well, I'm thinking of majoring in English, Dot said. Dorothy clapped her hands in delight.
How lovely! The world needs more literature professors.
Actually, I was thinking of becoming a writer, Dot said quietly. Dorothy didn't seem to hear her.
And maybe you'll read my book for your course, she crowed. I'm sure it'll be on the syllabus once it's published. I mean, I'm no Henry James, but they have lots of modern fiction on course lists these days, don't they? I'm much better than those dreadful modernists, for sure. And Stephen Crane?
She made a gagging sound.
They could definitely bump him.
Dot reached for her champagne glass again, trying not to feel overlooked. Dorothy had been out of practice talking to people for a while, that was all. Dot should just let her prattle on. She didn't want anything to be wrong with this evening. She wanted it to go exactly as her aunt desired. Eliza. It is a bitch to get to Stedman's Curiosity Shop in Venice. So many highways, so many traffic lights, idiots on cruiser bicycles, homeless crackheads lying in the middle of the street. It's even worse because I still haven't picked up my car from Palm Springs, which means I have to rely on a cab driver to take me, and the stopping and starting traffic makes me carsick. When I finally get there to start my shift that Friday, 2 days after the cat show, I feel my usual disappointment with my surroundings. The place always looks a lot better in my mind's eye. The shop is one notch above a hovel, shoved onto a side street near the canals, and lit by a single orange bulb. The single room seems to get smaller and narrower as the hours pass, closing the taxidermied heads and ancient medical equipment and necklaces made of bones over me like a cask. Sometimes, I'm not sure working here is worth the $8.50 an hour Stedman pays, which isn't even California's minimum wage. I sit on a tufted stool behind the antique cash register, jiggling my foot to the classical station on the radio. Though a meditative coach told me that classical music dissolves harmful pathways in the brain, it's still like nails on a chalkboard. I want to change the station, but Stedman has taped up so many rules about appropriate music for this place. No pop, no country, no rap, no Halloween. I think he wrote that last one just for my benefit. What does he think I'm going to do, listen to Monster Mash all day? Long shadows slope off the animal heads hanging on the walls. Several baby coffins balance atop a tall pile of boxes marked things like alligator teeth and freeze-dried turtles and Victorian human hair wreaths. There's a jewelry case bearing things like earrings made out of miniature doll legs, cicada wings, and voodoo chicken feet. Across the room, which is little more than an arm length away, is a flyer that reads, "Interested in taxidermy? Come to our class, May 12th. Guess who's teaching it? Me. Because clearly, that's all I'm qualified to do. Not write books. The Dvorak piece ends, and the DJ sleepily tells us what we're to hear next. I refresh my phone screen again and again, thinking I might have missed a call from Lance the detective or the bartender who may or may not be named Richie. This store has spotty service. The high concentration of human bones seemed to interfere with a cell signal. I hear a jingle and nearly drop the phone. It's ringing. But then I realize it's the front door, which is almost as unlikely. Most of our customers are creeps who order online. A figure stoops to get through the narrow door and stands for a moment next to the life-size bisque-faced man doll. As his features organize themselves, I cough out a laugh. Today he's got on a wine-colored hooded cape.
Desmond!
He shades his eyes and squints all 10 feet to where I am behind the register.
Eliza, it is you.
He sidesteps a few open boxes and approaches me. There's a big smile on his face, though it fades to disappointment when he sees my expression.
How did you know I work here? I demand. I looked you up online. There was a picture of a cat skeleton on your Twitter, and your location finder was on, so it was easy for me to pinpoint where you were.
He grinned triumphantly. My heart is thrumming in my ears. Location finder? What if Leonidas is stalking my Twitter too?
You should have just called me. I've been sending you texts all week.
Ah, but calling you lacked the mystery. I wanted to find you.
Then Desmond glances around the room. There's a strong odor of charred hair. Wind-up teeth chatter on a shelf.
This place is magnificent, he decides.
He spins on his heel and surveys the other side of the room.
There's a convention for people who like Ouija boards?
He points to a flyer next to some antique wigs.
In Baltimore, I say sulkily.
It's Ouija's birthplace.
He looks at me excitedly. I'll go if you go.
I give him a sour frown. No, thank you.
He points at a metal tool that looks like an oversized corkscrew. It's nestled in a rosewood box and is on sale for $930.
A tree fine, he says with adulation.
I chuckle despite myself. I can't help but be impressed.
You are one of the few people who actually know what it's called.
These are fascinating. Physicians thought that if they drilled holes in the skulls of patients who had brain disorders, they'd let out the bad spirits.
I know that.
One of my favorite paintings is by Hieronymus Bosch, of a guy laying on a chair and a doctor drilling into his head.
I have a print of that, if you're interested.
I grab a binder underneath the counter of laminated images we can order as posters. When I find the Bosch, Desmond taps the page with his pinky finger. He's wearing a signet ring.
He looks like the Tin Man, he says, pointing to the doctor with the drill. There's a metal funnel on his head.
Art experts say that's his hint that he's a quack, I say, enjoying showing off the only thing I can remember from the one art history class I took my first semester of college.
Well, of course he's a quack. He's drilling into the guy's head. Who wants to do that?
I shut the binder.
Why are you here? Did the police get in touch with you finally?
Desmond pauses.
Well, no. I haven't heard a thing. I just wanted to see how you were doing, my fairest.
He wiggles his eyebrows. All at once, I flash back on my humiliating lunge toward him the day he came to my house. What had possessed me to do such a thing? It's kind of a relief that he's shown up today. I'd conjured that absinthe with Paul, holy shit you won't believe what this weird girl did to me scene in my mind too many times over the past several days. I fold my hands and try to look proper and sober, though it's difficult when surrounded by stuffed parrots and antique bird cages and a huge sign over my head that reads, just in, whale penises.
I'm hanging in there, I admit,
though I sound so miserable it can hardly be accepted as the truth. Desmond's brow furrows. Then his voice drops an octave, as though he doesn't want the taxidermy animals to overhear.
So I might as well get to my point and let you get on with your work.
Would you like to partake in a beverage with me sometime?
I stare at him.
Do you mean go out for a drink?
In layman's terms, exactly.
A date. I'm unequipped for one of those. I feel I've never really gone on one. Then again, I must have. There was Leonidas. If only I remembered what sorts of dates we went on.
Desmond leans his elbows on the counter. I'll take you anywhere you want. I'll do whatever.
He smiles kinkily, which is not unattractive, exactly.
I'm kind of busy, I say automatically.
Are you sure? You can't even spare time for an aperitif?
I don't know what that is.
What about coffee?
Even for 10 minutes, whenever you're done with work today.
He tilts his head, and his woolly eyebrows hood over his lashes.
We parted so inelegantly last time, and far too abruptly for my liking.
Maybe he had wanted to have sex with me. Maybe he'd spent the last 4 days ruining how he'd chickened out. I fiddle with a rabbit's foot Stedman keeps next to one of the brass register keys. The thing is, I am awfully lonely. I crave sex, but I can get sex. It's closeness that's more elusive. Sometimes, I get the urge to walk through a parking lot next to someone, to hold someone's hand, to have someone make me a sandwich or place a washcloth on my head when I'm sick. I don't know if that person is Desmond. I still can't quite imagine kissing him without bursting out laughing. But a little companionship would be nice. Then I think of Leonidas again. I have that to figure out, and I've decided on what I'm going to do. There's something I need to take care of after work. I'll join you. He instantly looks sheepish. Sorry, it's just that I so rarely get days off when the convention is in full swing, and I'd love to see you. But if I'm being outré, you can tell me to cease and desist. It's okay, I say slowly, considering. I shouldn't rope Desmond into this, but it might not be a bad idea to bring him along. I take a breath. I'm actually looking into my killer, or, well, almost killer. You mean from the pool? He puffs out his narrow rib cage. I'll definitely accompany. You need protection. Are you sure? Because I have this idea of what I need to do, and you might not like it. Desmond pretends to peel back his wrist and toss something in front of me. The gauntlet has been thrown. It's a wonder he doesn't have a real gauntlet. When are you off? I'll meet you here anon. I tell him, and he swoops his cape and exits with Edwardian flair. I am left with a symphony of strings and a whole bunch of lifeless, staring animals. I look around at them, wishing I could ask them if that actually just happened. I feel excited, kind of, in an eye-rolling sort of way. But before I can really dwell on it, a busload pulls up and outpour the other sort of people who buy from this store. Busloads from God knows where, with their huge empty boxes. They look so normal, lumpy, suburban, and neighborly. But they come in here and fight over the weird objects rescued from baby stomachs and archaic tools of horrible things we used to do to one another before we knew any better. It's a phenomenon, really. 2 hours later, Stedman arrives, relieving me from my shift. We had great sales today, I crow. I am trying not to walk too unsteadily or slur my speech, but I actually had 3 shots of mead, the only liquor I could find under a 2-foot-high pile of papers in the cramped back room, in order to quell my buzzing nerves for my big Leonidas investigation. We got a bus of tourists from Pasadena. Stedman slams his briefcase down on the counter and juts a thumb at the front door. Someone's waiting for you outside. At first, I think he's pissed because he knows I've been drinking. But then he adds, he's driving a Batmobile, and he's taking up all the good parking. He's driving a what? I scurry out from behind the counter. It takes me only a second and a half to cross the store and open the front door. Sure enough, Desmond is standing at the curb, and I'll be damned. He's stolen Batman's car. 4 I have something to tell you, Dot said softly to Marlin during art history. They were talking about the Impressionists that day, paintings of ethereal flowers and rain-speckled streets. It was exactly the sort of art Dot wasn't into. When she was young, if she walked into a doctor's office with a Monet print on the walls, she would turn and walk right out. Dorothy would indulge this and say Monet made her want to kill herself, too. Marlin gazed at her with interest, putting down his pen. But then, because Dot was afraid of anyone overhearing, she wrote it down on a piece of paper and slid it toward him. My aunt is back. You know who. And of course he knew. They were together by then. Dorothy was all Dot talked about. I'm secretly meeting with her every Wednesday, Dot wrote after he read this first part and widened his eyes. She wants to meet you. She slipped the paper to him again. He read it, nodded, and then wrote something down. Sure, I'm in. That made him eat the paper so no one would see. On Wednesday, they got into Marlin's car.
Where are we going to meet her?
He said excitedly.
The Ivy? That new Korean place on Melrose? An S&M club. I mean, she's fabulous and up for anything, right?
Actually, she really likes this steakhouse in Alhambra, Dot said. Her boyfriend made a face. She squeezed his hand. It's cool, I promise. Wait until she tells you her stories. You'll be blown away.
Marlin's brow creased anyway when he saw M&F, which looked, Dot suddenly noticed, only a notch better than the Texas Roadhouse chain.
It's really nice inside, she said, gesturing to the valet line. Of course, they didn't use the valet. As usual, Dot went for the back entrance, rapping on the door like a pro.
What's with the speakeasy thing? Marlin grumbled uncertainly.
Dot beamed. That's exactly what Dorothy said.
There. It was kismet. He and Dorothy were going to hit it off for sure.
Dorothy hadn't arrived yet. Dot settled into her regular chair, and Marlin sat across from her.
Shouldn't we be at a better table? He asked. We're next to a utility closet. Our food is going to taste like bleach.
Oh, stop, Dot said. No one bugs us here. We can talk. The bartender Dot now knew well was mopping the bar. He looked up and smiled.
Champagne?
He said, and it materialized immediately. Bernie, the waiter, set down three glasses, one for Dot, one for her boyfriend, and one at Dorothy's empty seat. Marlin looked at Dot nervously.
I thought you only liked beer.
Dot shot him a look. Don't be such a prude. Dorothy appeared in the back hall in a flurry of mink and silk. Dot shot to her feet. Marlin lingered shyly behind her. Dorothy hugged both of them, exclaiming over and over how nice it was to meet Dot's boyfriend. What a specimen he was.
So tall, she cried, touching the top of his head. And that hair. You should bottle it. And what do you do to remain so slender?
Marlin blushed.
Genetics, I guess.
Lucky, Dorothy said, winking at him flirtatiously. They sat down. Marlin was still nervous and twitchy. Dorothy took a big gulp of champagne and made a face.
No wonder you're not drinking this.
She pulled a flask out of her bag and snapped her fingers. Two lowball glasses appeared.
From my special vault.
She poured brown liquid for both of them.
What is it? Marlin asked. Whiskey, darling.
Dorothy grinned. Marlin gave Dot a skeptical look.
I'm not really into whiskey.
Dot kicked him under the table. So don't drink it, she thought angrily. Just don't be a killjoy. She drank the whiskey heartily, with big swallows, ignoring the burning sensation in her belly. Dorothy began to tell Marlin the tale of her African tribesman lover, Otufu. She included details she hadn't told Dot, hiding in a whorehouse in some Somali village, having an assault rifle thrust into her hands in case she needed to defend herself, watching Otufu's henchmen murder a man inside Otufu's compound. Marlin blinked rapidly. Dorothy finally waved her hand in front of his face.
Hello? You still in there?
I feel like I'm in a movie, Marlin murmured. Dorothy slung her arm around him.
Love this one, darling, she said to Dot. He's a keeper.
Steaks, then, and a limo to a club Dorothy knew about for dancing. The club was through an entrance down a dingy set of steps. Halfway to the door, Dorothy paused and glared at the sidewalk.
I think it was a paparazzo, she whispered, pointing to someone with a camera.
She pulled her scarf over her head and ducked out of sight. Inside the club, foreign types, emaciated models, drunk bodybuilders. Dorothy kept her scarf over her head the whole time, a makeshift hijab. Dot danced wildly, feeling unhinged and free. At 2 a.m., Marlin gently pushed Dot away when she tried to put her hands down his pants.
Babe,
You seem really drunk, he said gently. Dot peppered him with kisses.
Nah, I'm great.
I'm worried about you. I want to make sure this isn't hurting your brain, you know?
I've hardly had anything to